Support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign. Locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about American politics, and our guest is Donna Brazile. She has, for something like half her life, been involved with politics, and she's not all that old, so clearly she got a start when she was quite young. She has written about some of this in a new memoir that's just recently come out. It's titled Cooking with Grease. The subtitle is Stirring the Pots in American Politics. It's published by Simon & Schuster. She is out now talking about it, and it was good enough to give us some of her time, joining us this morning by telephone. Let me tell you just a little bit more about her. She currently is a fellow at the Institute of Politics at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. She has been involved in a number of political campaigns. In 1984, she was deputy campaign manager for Jesse Jackson's presidential campaign. She served in former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis' presidential campaign. From 1990 through 99, she served as chief of staff to D.C. Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton, and then she also served as campaign manager during the final months of former Vice President Al Gore's presidential campaign in the year 2000. So she continues to be quite active in politics, particularly trying to get people out to vote. She is also now chair of the Democratic National Committee's Voting Rights Institute, and she's joining us by telephone. Questions are welcome, please. The only thing we ask of people is that people are brief, just so we can keep moving. But anyone's welcome to call 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Ms. Brazile, hello.
Good morning, David. Call me Donna. Thanks so much for having me on the show this morning.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. I want to ask you about the title. What does that mean, Cooking with Grease?
Well, I'm one of nine kids. I grew up in Louisiana, and that's one of the favorite titles that my mother would say from time to time, that we had to cook with grease, meaning we had to get up and get things done and get moving. It also refers to the intensity, the heat involved in working on a presidential campaign. And often I would tell the staff that we were cooking with grease. We had to stir the pots to get things moving. So I love the title, so I decided to use it with my first book.
Hmm. Tell me the story about when you were 9 years old. You're going door to door trying to get some interest in somebody who was running for, was it the city council?
City council, that's correct. My little town of Kenna is located outside of New Orleans. I'm a native there, grew up on the banks of the Mississippi. I came of age during a time America was changing. Martin Luther King was assassinated on April 4th, 1968. And as far back as I can recall, I wanted to be a civil rights worker. And, of course, my grandmother would always say to me, Donna, why don't you be a doctor? And I said, well, Grandma, I don't like blood. Well, be a nurse. I said, well, I don't like doctors. And so I wanted to be a civil rights worker, and that transformed me a lot as a young person. When King was assassinated, I wanted to get involved in politics, and so Miss Minor, who was the activist, lived a block away from us, came to my mom and said, since Donna knew all of the neighbors, why don't you allow her to go with me door to door to see who's registered? And I did it. I went door to door with my cousins and my brothers and my friends. We found out that some of that over 200 people were not registered, and guess what? We got them registered, and we got a playground. I was so excited about the playground. Of course, he promised my parents a paved road, but we didn't have a car. That didn't bother me, but he kept his promise to build a playground, and of course, to this day, that playground, Pellerin, still stands as an institution that brings people together in our neighborhood.
How is it that someone that young decides that they want to be active in civil rights? Were there particular people that for you looked up to and you thought, well, I want to be like that person?
You know, I would often lay in bed at night with my grandmother. We had a lot of kids, so we had to bundle up. And I would say, Grandma, what was it like growing up in the 1800s? She was born in 1887. What was it like in the 1900s? I had a keen interest of what was going on because I would talk to my grandmother about her life and my great-grandfather about his life. And I knew what had happened. I knew about slavery. I knew about, you know, segregation. I knew about the lynching. And I just thought it was wrong, and I wanted to do something. I felt that that was the most urgent need. I didn't like hearing the stories because they sounded so painful. I couldn't do anything. I was a little girl, and I just thought that if I grow up, I can get involved in a movement, and I can make sure that no one had pain anymore and suffering. So that was my way of contributing to the process. I read every day the newspapers. I knew what was happening all around the world, and especially in our home city of Louisiana and New Orleans. And I just wanted to be actively involved. I wanted to go to the protests. I wanted to lead the rallies, and I was just a dreamer, but I wanted to get involved, and that stayed with me. And it still is with me today. I still, whenever I see people being hurt, whenever I hear or witness people in any way being harmed, I want to help. I want to do something.
Yeah. It seems to me that you're, and you correct me if I'm wrong about this, your involvement in politics has always been as a behind-the-scenes kind of person. You have never run yourself for office?
That's correct. I've never had the desire to run, although I've talked about it with friends. But I love being behind the scenes. In the Gore campaign, of course, when you become campaign manager, you're not so behind the scene anymore. You're out front and center. But I have worked on over 50 campaigns throughout my life, and I've been involved, like you said, since I was a little girl. And I enjoy just being behind the scenes, getting people excited, getting them passionate, going door to door, organizing, identifying, and recruiting people to go in and get involved in their own future. That's what politics is about, is having a voice in the process.
I know that among people in politics and in both parties, but I think this is maybe a little bit of a more acute in the Democratic Party than it is in the Republican Party. They're concerned with getting people to vote, and not just anyone. Levels of participation of African Americans and Latinos and even Asian Americans are really low. There are a lot of people that obviously feel that there's no point in them getting involved in the process. Why, I guess, first of all, why do you think that particularly among these groups of folks, Black Americans, Latinos, and a lot of Asian Americans, they think that there's no point in them participating in politics?
Well, for starters, we have to remove obstacles to participation. In states where voter registration rules and regulations are very accessible to ordinary citizens, there's a higher level of participation. But look at the Deep South. That's where I'm from. One-third of eligible Black men are not, are not able to register and participate in the political process because they have some form of conviction, misdemeanor, felony conviction. And although they've served their time and paid their dues back to society, they cannot register to vote. In other places, in addition to the age hurdle, you have to, go to a certain location in order to register to vote. It's not readily available when you turn 18. So the barriers must come down before we can talk about access and the experience of people who want to get involved in the political process. If we remove the barriers, I think more people will register, more people will participate. But also, look at young people of all colors, all stripes, all background. They're not actively involved. More young people got involved and voted in the last American Idol series for Ruben Aclea, Fantasia, and Diana than participated in the 2000 presidential election. And there's no problem. They just don't like politicians. They don't like the political parties. They don't believe that they're addressing their issues or their needs. And we have to change that in our country. We spend over $1 billion on elections, yet we rarely talk to the people, who we need to get out and get involved in the political process. I hope we change that this political season, and I'm trying to do my part.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Donna Brazile. She's been involved in American politics for a long time, was involved with the presidential campaign of Jesse Jackson in 1984, also with the Dukakis campaign for president. After that, she spent a number of years as chief of staff to D.C. Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton, and then most recently, during the final months of the Gore 2000 presidential campaign, she was the campaign manager, and she's authored a memoir that's about her experiences, those and others, in politics, titled Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in American Politics, and it's out now, and it's published by Simon & Schuster, and questions are certainly welcome. People who are listening want to call in and talk with our guest, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. We do also have that toll-free line, and that is 800 800- 1-800-222-9455. I want to get you a chance to talk a little bit about the presidential race of 2000. And I know in some of the comments I've seen you made in connection with traveling around talking about the book that you say that you do think the campaign made some mistakes in 2000. I'm sure any time that you run a campaign, if you're not successful, no matter who you are, you're always going to look back and say, well, okay, what did we do? What should we have done differently? What do you think went wrong with the 2000 campaign as far as the Democrats were concerned?
Well, there's no question that you have to reflect back on, you know, the things you did well. Gore came from behind. He was 20 points behind. Many Americans sort of forget that. He was outspent by $180 million. That's a lot of money to go up against. But I believe Al Gore did a great job. He was a fantastic candidate. He stood for all of the right causes and issues, from, you know, growing the prosperity to providing health care to all. But at the end of the day, when you don't win your home state of Tennessee, when you spend months trying to figure out how to use the former president, Bill Clinton, and, of course, when you go down to Florida and have voters confused up and down the, you know, the state, then it's difficult to have a winning campaign strategy. Yet, we had more votes than the other guy, and I believe it had all of the votes been counted and the Supreme Court not intervened in the election, this election would have been Al Gore's. He would have been the president of the United States. That's the way I feel. And I got involved in the Al Gore campaign soon after the 1998 congressional campaigns. I started in April of 1999. I became campaign manager on September 29th. I was campaign manager because the campaign had fallen behind in raising money and also and fallen behind a little bit with Bill Bradley in the two key states, Iowa and New Hampshire. So when I took over the campaign, it was at a time when the campaign was trying to rebound to get its sea legs back and to really refocus on getting Gore's message out to the people. If I had to do it all over again, I really would have spent additional resources and time in Tennessee, although I lived there. The polls indicated that Gore was up by 10, but that was the poll. The people were, you know, a little bit less inclined to vote for him.
I think some people have real concerns about the process that's used to select candidates and that it may not always end up with the best candidate. And particularly this time around, the head of the Democratic National Committee had this idea that he wanted to cut down on the infighting among Democrats, wanted to get a candidate, make the decision as soon as possible. So the process was very front loaded. And so that what happened, he got what he wanted. And I think also a lot of people looked at and said, well, you know, maybe that wasn't such a great idea, because then here would be this long period of time where essentially it would be very difficult to make news and get your candidate in the news. And then, of course, there are a lot of Democrats who are saying, look, I'm going to support the Democratic candidate, but I'm less than thrilled with Mr. Kerry. So, you know, looking at all of that, what do you think about the way that the system that we have now, the way that we go about choosing a candidate?
I like the system. I wish more states are in play. The only part of this system I don't like is the general election, where the two candidates, I mean, I saw the president early this morning in Pennsylvania. That's his 29th visit. I've been to Pennsylvania 10 times, Florida 10 times, Nevada 5 times. We only play in certain states. I would like to come to Illinois. I've only been there once because it's not a battleground state. So the system in terms of the primary gives citizens a chance in some of the early states to seat all of the candidates, look at them up close and personal, and make a decision. And then, but if your state comes late in the game, like Illinois and some other states, you don't really get a chance to see all of the candidates. You only get to see the top two or the top person. So we need to figure out in the next go-round, perhaps with Republicans and Democrats working together, because I ultimately believe some of these problems have to be addressed by both parties. We've got to find a way to get more states involved and in play during the primary process, and perhaps in the general election we can expand the battleground to include big states like Illinois, so that they can get some of the personal attention and some of the attributes that I believe is essential to our democracy. At least you have a Senate race now, and I understand it's heating up. I have a favorite in that race, of course. I'm a Democrat, and I like Barack Obama. But at least you have something there. You have many congressional campaigns that hopefully will get people very passionate about participating in the process this year.
Well, do you think that Mr. McAuliffe was made a mistake in setting up the process to get the early nominee?
No, I don't. I supported Terry in the move to create a primary system. Again, when you're creating a primary system 2-3 years out, it looks good on paper. And I thought the primary system, effectively gave us a nominee in February, and John Kerry has been able to not only rally the Democrats, energize the Democrats, but the party is very united behind John Kerry. I mean, over 90% of Democrats support John Kerry. That's better than Al Gore. We, at this same point 4 years ago, we only had the support of 67% of Democrats. So John Kerry's in a very good strategic position, and I wish him the best, and I also intend to vote for him as well.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly what I would expect from you.
No, sir. I mean, there are some Democrats I wouldn't support. I would just say I'm on vacation. I will vote, but not that person. I have voted independent before. You know, I'm from Louisiana. My governor once said the only way he'll ever be defeated if he was caught in bed with a live boy or a dead girl, and I voted that year independent. Mm.
Well, I'm sure that there are a lot of Democrats who will be supporting the candidate, but perhaps not because they're that excited about Mr. Kerry, but because what they want to do is they want to get rid of Mr. Bush. How many people do you think are those who would say, honestly, well, you know, maybe John Kerry's not the most exciting guy I can think of, but as a Democrat, I think George Bush is more exciting?
I mean, you know, I keep getting this question. I got it back in 2000. I thought it was funny. And he said, well, Gore is boring. I said, I don't want James Brown as president. I want someone who, a man of substance, or a person of substance. I would like to see someone who's analytical, who is of good, strong temperament, who has strong values, who has intelligence. That's what I'm looking for. I'm not looking for somebody that make me excited. I'm already passionate. I can stir up more people than you can, you know, find on a block. But we somehow or another in the process believe that we need someone exciting. I think that's not the way folks think about their candidate. Now, I know there are a lot of activists out there that want to find somebody that can make them jump up and holler, and Howard Dean was that candidate, perhaps, or Dennis Kucinich or Al Sharpton. But we're now at the phase of the campaign where we need to look at both contenders, Bush as well as Kerry, and say, okay, who can keep us safe and secure? Who can help us, you know, get America's economic house in order? Who can provide health care? Let's test them, let's judge them, but this word of call excitement sort of confuses me because I'm not looking for an exciting candidate.
Hmm. What do you think about the way so far Mr. Kerry has been running his campaign, what he's been doing, the kind of issues that he's been talking about?
I think John Kerry is laying a great foundation for the future. He has put forward a plan to grow the economy, create 10 million jobs. He said he would invest in the middle class, that he would give tax breaks and tax credits to corporations that stay here and create jobs versus those that go offshore and outsource our jobs. John Kerry has a health care plan that would provide every child in this country with health care, something I believe that's essential. He also has a plan, I believe, to help restore America's respect abroad by bringing our allies together to help us win the global war on terrorism, as well as to help us win the peace and finish the job in Iraq so our troops can come home. Let me just say, I'm one of these Democrats that I take a look every day at John Kerry's website, the www.johnkerry.com. I also look at the opposition website as well just to see what they're thinking. But I like the fact that he's laying a foundation for the future and that he's telling the American people what he would do as president. So this is not an election about anybody but Bush, but an election about our future, our values, our security, our jobs, and our health care. That's what John Kerry is talking about.
Hmm. Well, what do you think, when time comes for people to go to the polls, what do you think that there will be some issue or issues that will be uppermost in their minds when they make that decision, who should be whether President Bush should be continue to be president or whether John Kerry should be president?
Absolutely, sir. I believe that the American people will, first of all, think about whether or not they're safe and secured. I think that is probably the most important issue, the war on terrorism, the war in Iraq. And I say that as an American citizen who live, you know, in Washington, D.C., on Capitol Hill. That is number one for me. The second one, of course, is the economy. People will look in their wallets and say, you know, I'm working 8-12 hours a day. Am I earning more or am I earning less? They'll look at their retirement security. They'll look at their schools. They'll look at their health care facilities. I hope that this dialogue, we raise the level of conversation about what's at stake in this election to the Supreme Court. Basically, we have a $2.6 trillion budget, and we can't solve our problems at home because we have priorities are misplaced. We're mishandled money. We're back in deficits. That's going to strangle any economic growth that is being created right now with these jobs that have no benefits. So this is a crucial election. This is a time when every American citizen, regardless of how they feel about politicians, regardless of how they feel about the two political parties, they should get involved because by voting, they can change. They can change America, and that's what we should do this fall.
We have a caller here ready to go, and certainly others who are listening would be welcome to join the conversation. If you'd like to talk with our guest, Donna Brazile, 333-9455 is the Champaign Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line that's good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. The first caller is in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. I'll just preface by saying the only Democratic candidate that excited me was Dennis Kucinich, so you can understand why I'm somewhat disheartened about state of presidential politics. But be that as it may, I think it's crucial to get rid of the Bush-Cheney regime. But back to the last election, I'm still angry about the way that election was stolen, and I'm proof positive that it was stolen. And there's certainly lots of evidence to that to prove that. And I'm also still somewhat upset with the Democratic Party for just sort of, to me, it seemed like they rolled over on that and did not make an issue of it. You know, they just sort of tucked their tail between their legs and walked off the stage. And I'm wondering, you know, maybe you have some sense of this. Are the Democrats going to, you know, be more proactive this time to make sure that the election isn't stolen again? Because I'm absolutely convinced that, you know, the Republicans are going to try to steal it again. I mean, they're already doing things in Florida and other states. You know, the probably the most telling thing is where they changed the law since the last election so that it's illegal to identify, for people to identify who's been scrubbed from the voter list.
Well, this call is very well informed, and sir, I am living testament to what happened 4 years ago, and I want to help change that. That's why I'm not just on a book tour, but I'm on a tour to help restore voters' confidence in our political process. This is our election. We cannot allow election official governors and others to basically stop people from voting by scrubbing the voter rolls. I'm proud to say that not only is Senator Bill Nelson, but the ACLU and NAACP and CNN have sued the state of Florida to try to get a copy of that list so that we can talk to those citizens and get their voting rights restored in time for this election. I think it is just immoral that we basically strip ordinary citizens of their voting rights under the pretense that we're cleaning the list, when in fact we should be lowering the barriers, removing the barriers so that all citizens can participate, all citizens can have provisional ballots. 40 states have requested waivers for implementing the Help America Vote Act. Why? Because the federal government is not giving them enough money. The Republican chairman of the Commission on Election Reform in our country said he doesn't have enough money. I say to you, Congress, Mr. President, put money in the budget so that we can conduct a free and fair election in this country. We need resources to ensure that all our election officials are trained, our poll workers are trained, that these machines that they have rushed to make will also work properly and they're secure so that every citizen can have an adequate opportunity to have their vote counted. We can make the difference. We don't need to rely on Jeb Bush or Catherine Harris this time. We're the citizens. This is our country. Let us go to polls and protect those poll workers and protect those voters as well.
Well,
thank you, caller.
I certainly hope that the Democrats don't roll over again on this, because I just...
We're not going to roll over, sir. I can promise you that. I'm on the road, and I'm telling you, I'm going out in the country. I'm recruiting people. I'm using the proceeds of my book to make sure that we can print sample ballots that people understand. I'm doing my part, and I believe the party will do its part by making sure that we have resources to help, you know, in all of these majority precincts that we will target, Democratic performing precincts as well as other performing precincts. We got to target voters and ensure that they have sample ballots and that they know that they have the right to vote. Some citizens don't know when they walk in the polling place and, you know, they've run out of ballots, that they can, you know, request a provisional ballot, or they can request that, you know, they vote absentee. We got to tell people what they can and cannot do, and that's what we intend to do at the Voting Rights Institute.
Yeah, I think most people still don't realize that when they recounted the entire state of Florida, that Gore actually picked up more votes in some of the Republican counties than they did in some of the Democratic counties, and, you know, he actually won that election.
He won it, and even with the recount of the recount, they lost 8,000 ballots, but still I believe that Gore, look, I mean, I can go county by county in Florida. I've lived it. And tell you, in the places where people were confused, they not only wrote Al Gore's name, they tried to punch it. So I feel for the people in Florida. I know the kind of confusion they dealt with. In Duval County, Jacksonville, 27,000 people had their ballots invalidated because the election official gave them a ballot that said vote all pages. This is not just a phenomenon that took place in Republican counties, but it took place in Democratic counties where people just didn't have the tools they need to cast an informed vote. That's why we have to change the system, we have to reform it, and we have to provide the funding. We have more money in the budget for Baghdad elections in Iraq next year than elections here in America, and that needs to change in 2004 as well.
All right, thank you.
All right.
Thank you, sir. God bless you and help us.
We'll go next to a caller in Crete, and this is line number 4. Hello.
That was an election that Gore lost, I think, more than Bush won. I think, for example, taking Tennessee for granted was a terrible mistake.
If you agree.
Your own state, by God, what can you win? Also, his attitude during some of the debates on television seemed to either show that he was contemptuous of his opponent or just absolutely bored to death, which came over as a negative again. So, again, those two things. Plus, the native factor hasn't been talked about. I just wondered, they maintain that Nader was the man who stole the chicken coop or something. And I just wonder what you felt about Nader's role in that last election, and what do you think he will play an important role in this election?
Thank you, caller. First of all, I have to totally agree with you about Tennessee. It's one of the toughest things, and I talk about it a lot in my book, David, is that you're a campaign manager, and you're living in Tennessee, and you're telling the consultants who fly in and out that things don't look well, don't feel well, but they keep saying, well, the polls say, well, I'm like, the polls don't vote, people vote. They took the pulse, but they didn't really figure out the temperature. And many Tennesseans had grown pretty much away from Al Gore. Many of them were newcomers to the state and didn't know anything about the Gore family. We never touched them. We never talked to them. And in politics, if you don't talk to people and touch them where they live, where they play and they pray, they don't really bother to support you. That was a mistake debate. You're right. We were too hot on one. We were too cold on the other and indifferent on the last one. And I don't think we scored as often as we could. That's one lesson that John Kerry should learn from our experiences, that don't go in there and assume that George W. Bush is not a smart man. He's very smart. And I disagree with everybody I've talked to that they say, well, he's not. And I'm saying, y'all don't know him, because he is. He knows how to play the game. He knows how to answer it so that he comes across as being very calm, very humorous, very assure of himself. And that's what the American people think of him, not those of us who are activists and inside the Beltway. Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader played a game in 2000 that he should be ashamed of, and apparently he's not ashamed. He met with the Congressional Black Caucus yesterday. I understand it was one of the most contentious meetings in the world. And the Black Caucus appealed to him not to campaign in battleground states, not to go out there and to criticize and to challenge Democrats. If he's going to go out there and be an independent, then be an independent, but not take on one party, take them both on. In 2000, he took on Gore. He took on the Democratic Party. His activists came to our events and demanded to get a seat at the table. His activists protested against us, not the other side. His activists accepted or did not reject resources from the Republican Party to run ads when he needed them. So my feeling about Ralph Nader is that Nader had an agenda, and his agenda was to elect George Bush, and that was his agenda.
Do you think he'll play an important role in this election?
Sir, there's no question that if Democrats ignore Ralph Nader, Ralph Nader will find sea legs, and he will get on the ballot, and he could cause a siphoning of anywhere between 2 to 4%. Kerry has met with him. The Black Caucus has met with him. I think it's time that progressives and others who believe in the things that are essential to our democracy rally together and make sure that Ralph Nader doesn't have the impact that he had in 2000, like 2000.
If Kerry came to you tomorrow and said, I would like your advice on who I should choose as a vice presidential candidate, would you give me two or three names? Well, who did you...
Yes, sir. I'm a Southerner, so I'm not a biased person, but I am a Southerner, and I tell you this, I don't like to see my part of the country written off by the Democratic Party. I grew up as a Democrat, and I grew up at a time when Democrats stood for something, and I like the party to continue to stand for something. So, yes, I would give him a name of John Edwards, perhaps, Wesley Clark, perhaps. My own two home state senators, Mary Landrieu, John Breaux, the two senators from the state of Florida, Mr. Graham, Mr. Nelson, a board of state gentleman who I have a great deal of respect for and affection, Dick Gephardt. I worked for him in 1988. I could go on, but we have an embarrassment of riches on the Democratic side. I hope he chooses a Democrat, and I hope he chooses someone that could help him not just win a state, but help him govern in the fall.
One more question, if you don't mind.
Yes, sir.
If John Kerry asked you to recommend something that he would change in the next few months that he has done in the past, would you recommend any critical changes in his campaign methods or techniques?
Yes, sir. I would do it with a heartbeat. And this is my passion. I only have one passion in life outside of just being a good cook and a good public servant and a daughter, of course. My passion is I like to see more citizens get involved in the process. They have spent millions of dollars on advertisement. I understand they have to, counter the Bush ads. But why not send bumper stickers and buttons and posters and yard signs to every state in the country and say, here, make this your campaign. You become the John Kerry headquarters on my block, on your block. And that's what I think he should do. He should spend some of the time and resources getting ordinary citizens excited about his campaign so that we can stir the passion, not with the candidate, but perhaps with our neighbors and our friends, and talk about what Kerry can do in the White House and to pass those comments and the message along to him. When he's on an airplane, riding across, driving across, flying across the country, he can read from ordinary people what they want to see in the White House, the kind of policies and the kind of people. That's what I like grassroots organizing.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Just to be clear, Donna, what you're saying about Ralph Nader, he's in the race. He's going to be in, and I don't think anybody's going to change his mind about that. It sounds like you're saying, though, what you think that the Democratic Party should do would be to look at what his issues are and the positions that he takes and try to embrace some of those as a way of attracting people who might want to vote for Mr. Nader, and in that way, see if you could persuade some of those people to vote for Mr. Kerry.
I agree. I think Mr. Kerry and Mr. Nader are more alike and have more in common in terms of issues than Mr. Nader and Mr. Bush. And I think that Mr. Kerry should adopt some of those essential ingredients, put them in our platform, and go out there and tell the American people, here's where I stand, here's what I believe, and here's why I believe it's important. And Ralph Nader would understand that we're not going to sit back and let him, siphon off our votes this year. This is an election that's going to be very close. It's going to be a base election, meaning that, base voters will be crucial, as well as swing voters. But base voters in both parties are being targeted, and Ralph Nader must understand that John Kerry will not give up an inch of ground to him.
Most people, the vast majority of people, are never going to have the opportunity to meet a presidential candidate personally. That's just not going to happen. So they're making their decisions based on what they see on television, maybe what other people they know feel. So that can show you why a campaign can turn on such a small number of appearances by a candidate like debates, for example. I don't know how many there'll be, but I imagine there'll only be a couple, and that makes them extremely important, puts a great deal of pressure on the candidate. I don't know if there's any way to make things like that less important, but maybe the question is, well, you know, what sort of advice do you give a candidate going into a situation like that, knowing, first of all, knowing that it could be make or break, and then trying to tell the person, but, you know, relax and be cool. I don't know how you do that with that kind of pressure.
Well, you know, here's the thing, and I really believe, and maybe because I've been on the campaign trail all my life, I know we overprepared Al Gore. I mean, we just, first of all, you have to basically give him all of his opposition research plus all of his policy proposals, and then you have to give him all of the opposition research from the other side and all of their policy proposals. So the first thing I would hope is that John Kerry would bring a smaller briefcase so that he doesn't have to, you know, read up on every little last detail about himself, his voting record, or Mr. Bush's voting record. Let's go into debates perhaps with two or three issues and say, look, this debate we're going to talk about foreign policy, or we're going to address two important questions facing this country, health care and in our manufacturing sector, our jobs. Let's have a debate on foreign policy. Let's talk about Iraq, and then let's talk about the global war on terror. I think if we simplified the process and the candidates could go in there figuring out one or two things and not trying to figure out, you know, when George Bush was 8 years old, did he buy his cannon, and then did he spit his gum on the sidewalk? Let's elevate the level of discussion and dialogue, and perhaps more people will tune in and say, yes, I want to know what George Bush. Now, see, George Bush and John Kerry has a lot in common. They both went to Yale. They both have health insurance. They haven't had to suffer. They didn't have. They don't. They never worked. Maybe they did, but they never had to work at a minimum wage. Let's talk about Mr. Bush, Mr. Kerry. If you had to live off $5-$15 an hour, how would you make ends meet? How would you make ends meet? I mean, let's get it real. Let's get it real. And I think if we did that, people would say, yeah, that guy could go in the White House and represent my values because he knows how I exist, how I survive every day. I think they should talk to my dad. My dad's a Korean veteran. He, you know, raised 9 kids, put 8 out of 9 of us through school, and, you know, he's retired now. He's a retired janitor. He was a janitor by day, and at night he was a carpenter or a plumber, whatever he could do with his hands. Go talk to my dad. My dad can give him some advice.
Our guest is Donna Brazile. She's been a political strategist for a long time, worked on a number of presidential campaigns, that of Jesse Jackson in 84. She also served in former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis' campaign and also worked during the final months of the Gore campaign in 2000. She is often called upon to comment on American politics. She's currently a fellow at the Institute of Politics at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and currently chairs the Democratic National Committee's Voting Rights Institute. She has authored a memoir of her experiences in politics. The book is titled Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in American Politics. It's published by Simon & Schuster. It is in the bookstore now if you want to read it. We have some other folks who would like to join the conversation here. We'll go next to a caller in Charleston, and that's line one. Hello.
Hi. Donna, I don't know if you remember me. I knew you from over 20 years ago when I was an intern at the Women's Equity Action League.
Oh, my God. Who's this?
Kate Wright.
Yeah. Long time.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. You're doing excellent.
Great.
I just wanted to let the caller... Huh?
Thank you.
I wanted the callers to know that I have known this woman for decades, and you have always been so bright, so passionate, so ethical, truly exemplary, and that I've always been impressed by you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
And I also disagree with the earlier caller who said that Democrats rolled over on the election. I think, frankly, it was the smartest thing to do, a respect for American law. That was the way it was done. That was the legal procedure. Did I like the outcome? No.
Yeah.
But anything less would have been a disrespect of American law. And I was amazed. You know, you and I are kids from the 60s and 70s. You know, Watergate to Vietnam and every other form of political dissolution that could be found.
Well,
for 6 weeks, we didn't know who the president was. And it didn't affect the stock market. And here we are in a place and time where nobody was talking about a military coup.
Right.
I was amazed.
Yeah.
But I'm definitely going to get your book. I think everything you said was totally on target. And I just wanted you to know that I've watched and admired for years.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, we came of age at a time when, you know, we were trying to not only make sure that Title IX was protected, but we also worked on many reproductive rights issues, many the early stages of the Family Medical Leave Act, and so many other important issues. And that was a time when I was so excited and still am excited about working on those issues.
But you
need to
tell them about your own Title IX story.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah. I remember just being shocked.
Yeah, can you imagine the attacks now that Title IX is under the Supreme Court is even about to look at it and review it?
And that if Title IX had never existed, what happened to you would be an everyday occurrence.
That is correct.
Tell people, please.
Absolutely. I mean, people forget that when I was coming of age, we had to wait for the boys to leave the basketball court or the volleyball so that we could play. We had to wait for them to leave the gym before we can go in. It was tough. I mean, Title IX opened doors for women in sports and women in education, and we need the law.
The other, I don't know if you were there for the speaker we had at Women's Equity Action League. She was a very, very bright black lawyer. She'd worked in the Justice Department.
Wow.
And I hadn't known that until 1974, sexual harassment was legal in this country. There was no law prohibiting it.
That's right.
And she had actually been working in the Justice Department, which has never been aptly named. And basically her boss pressured her to have sex or get lost. She went to his superior, who said, well, I value him more than I value you, so make a choice. It went into the courts in 1974. And she'd also been blackballed, basically, around Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Couldn't find another job. And part of what happened was, aside from the fact the government had obviously coached witnesses and the like, the other thing that happened was all the things that they were saying, that she was a woman scorned, and they had all these people who identified her from, you know, various places where they'd gone for their trysts. And then finally, the guy's real mistress, a different woman entirely, came in and said, no, that wasn't her, that was me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the case was won.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't understand how much change we've gone through and how important it is that we maintain what we have and push further.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to, and there's still lots to be done and more that could be done if we had someone in the White House who shared values, and I believe they're essential American values of freedom, equality, and opportunity for all. You know, I'm struck by the discussion now over gay marriage. I mean, the president went to Ohio the other day. They've lost over 250,000 jobs. Over 300,000 Ohioans without health insurance. Zero gay marriages. And yet he went to talk about gay marriage in Ohio. I'm like, well, why? If you want to talk gay marriage, come on out to California where I'm at, or go out to Massachusetts and talk about gay marriage there. I mean, that's where gay marriage has been performed. It's not been performed in Ohio. It's a divisive issue. And that's how we rally people by talking about what we're against. Huh?
Actually, what struck me is that I, in retrospect, why does the state offer marriage license? Why doesn't the state rather, I mean, a marriage is a religious thing that is now being given a legal sanctity. Why hasn't the state made that separate all along, or certainly go and make it separate now, and simply make it a domestic legal relationship?
As opposed to trying
to back up the religious, making it separate.
Right.
Well, I appreciate you, the call.
Well, I appreciate talking to an old friend, and thank you, David, for helping to bring us back.
Sure.
God bless you. And when you buy the book, email me. I'm Donna@cookingwithgrease.com. So please, let's stay in touch. I love to keep in touch with you and perhaps come to campus one day. I'm at Georgetown right now, but
I'm kind of married to Eastern Illinois University these days. So.
Amen. I love to come and teach one of your classes and vice versa when you're in the Washington area.
I will definitely email you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call.
Let's continue
here. And our next caller is in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. As a lead into what I want to say, I want to address myself to the statement made by the last caller, and that is that the Democrats did the right thing by not challenging the Supreme Court and going all the way on challenging the inauguration, the installation of Bush as Chancellor of the United States. Now, basically, they broke the law, and the Democrats didn't challenge it. And that's where I differ from the woman who just talked to you. My basic position is, and what I've been wondering for years is, the belief that I have that the people who run the Republican Party and most of their followers do not believe in the democratic system. They oppose the First Amendment to the Constitution, the 4th, 5th, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, and so on. They oppose a free press. They're against they want to destroy the Freedom of Information Act.
You're talking about the modern Republican Party, not the Republican Party of the past.
Well, I go back all the way to the Grant administration. It's essentially the same thing.
Because up until 1960, African Americans voted Republican.
That was because Lincoln was a Republican, but
that was a time lag. And but my party is no better on these issues. They've gotten much better over the last 40 years, but my party had to be challenged. The Republican Party should be challenged. And I hope the challenge come from within the same way it has come from the Democratic Party. We don't have perfect political parties. We don't have perfect political candidates. And God knows we now know we don't have the perfect democracy. We have to make it the most perfect democracy in the world if we're going to emulate it across the globe. I know what the caller was saying when she said, because Gore was in a real tizzy about it. He was the vice president of the United States. People went to bed that night thinking Bush had won because of what the media had reported. And our own decision to just challenge four counties and not all 67 was predicated on the fact that most Americans thought that Bush had won. And so we thought we could quickly get the recount over with by counting four counties. And, of course, we got involved in the legal tangle that ended up in the Supreme Court. Now, I hope the lesson I learned from 2000 was an important lesson about what we should do to prepare citizens to get involved in the process and to cast an informed vote. I hope the Supreme Court will not have to intervene again in our lives and overturn, in my judgment, the decision by the people to put in someone that they prefer. But in terms of these two parties, my friend, they have not been perfect. They have not been perfect.
I know that
very
well.
And we've got to make them better.
I know the Democrats haven't been perfect. I come from Cook County in Illinois, and previous to that, I came from Hudson County in New Jersey, so I know all about the Democrats.
And Illinois has had a lot of ballot spoilage as well. Cook County is notorious also.
And so are the Republicans in Illinois, and that's never come out in the newspapers.
I agree. I totally agree. You know, I have called it like it is all my life, and I'm going to continue to do that. But we need to fix all our systems, not just in Florida. We need to fix it in Illinois. We need to fix it in my home state of Louisiana, because we should not have another election where hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people are turned away from the polls and their ballots are spoiled and their votes go uncounted. It's just wrong. We need to change that.
We're coming to the point here. We just have a couple of minutes left. One question I do want to ask you, you know, some people, one of the criticisms that has been made of the Gore campaign in 2000 was that you all didn't know what to do with Mr. Clinton. Now, this time around, what sort of role do you see for President Clinton in the Kerry campaign?
There's no question that we spent months, agonizing months, debating internally what to do with Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton's approval ratings had plummeted to 30-35% in some battleground states, and we thought, well, you can't use somebody who's not as respected and loved as the candidate. I mean, Gore's approval rating was much higher than Clinton in many battleground states, so we used Bill Clinton in strategic areas where his numbers were very favorable versus those areas where his numbers, of course, were not. Now, this time around, Mr. Clinton's numbers are at 65% or higher. And therefore, I think John Kerry will be able to utilize him more effectively than we have in raising money and also going out there and rally the vote. I can tell you, I've been out in California now for 3 days, and people are so excited that he's coming out here. They're buying his book, and if you go on Amazon.com, you can buy my book and Bill Clinton book for $37. That's a real bargain, two for one. I say finally the first black president could help his little sister when, you know, people go out to the bookstore. So Bill Clinton is the ultimate jazz man and the ultimate political player in this world, and he knows how to conduct himself, and he will be very, very value plus for John Kerry.
Mm. I'm also interested, you just touched real briefly on the senatorial campaign we got going here. I know that a lot of people nationally are looking at Barack Obama and seeing what appears to be a very attractive candidate for a variety of reasons. It still, to me, seems amazing that now in the year 2004, we should be talking about the fact that if he would be elected, he only would be the third African-American in the Senate since Reconstruction.
It's a sad statement. And, of course, Barack Obama is not only well-qualified, and would be an excellent public servant for the people of Illinois. There's other pressure being placed on him, and I know why. It's the same pressure that's being placed on Ken Salazar, Hispanic American, running the Attorney General of the state of Colorado, who's running for the United States Senate, and Brad Carson, the congressperson from Oklahoma, who's running for the United States Senate. He's a Native American in South Carolina. And there's Tenenbaum, a Jewish American, running in South Carolina, and I can go on, but Mr. Obama is not just qualified, but I think that he would bring new life to the Senate. He would represent the values of the great state of Illinois. He would lead in the great tradition of our country in terms of having someone there who's hands-on that can make things happen in Washington, D.C. He has not just a wonderful resume, but his own career in public service demonstrates that he's someone that can cross the political aisle and to talk to the other side and to make sure that he can deliver for the people of Illinois good jobs, health care, education, and the like. So I am supporting him. I've sent him $100 every month. I'm up to $200 now, so I'm about to send him another $100. So I try to support candidates coming out of the primary, and he's my candidate, and I'm going to support him.
Well, I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Well, keep in touch. I'm Donna at cookingwithgrease.com, and thank you for having me on, and I hope to come back.
All right. Donna Brazile, her memoir, Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in American Politics.
Thank you, sir.
It's just out now, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Focus 580, this program is made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Support for the broadcast also comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine. In Urbana, the Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone, from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings held every Friday from 6 to 8 and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at corkscrew.com. And I think that's where we're going to wrap things up here. However, we want you to stay around because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine, and sitting in today as host, Tom Rogers.
Good afternoon, David. We've got an archive show coming up in place of Celeste Quinn, who's out today. And we apologize for the change in our schedule, but we'll bring you an archive interview from the 29th of April of this year, a biography of George Bent, who was born in 1843 to a white trader and a Cheyenne woman, a product of two great families. Until his death in 1918, George Bent lived in both different worlds of those two great families. And we will talk about the life of George Bent with David Fritchoff and Andrew Masick. They are the authors of Half Breed, the remarkable true story of George Bent caught between the worlds.